sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the first part of a two-part series on Russiagate. To me, Russiagate is very similar to 9/11 when you look at how the media covers it. A little investigative journalism would expose the fact that there's no solid evidence to support the claims of the Russian hacking of our elections, just as a little investigative journalism exposes the lies of 9/11. But the corporate so-called mainstream media is just an echo chamber of the powers that be when it comes to 9/11 and Russiagate. And my challenging the Russiagate story that we've been fed day and night for several years now does not mean that I support Trump. It's my belief that both political parties are corrupt beyond repair, and that all Democratic or Republican presidents since JFK were and are mere puppets of a deeper state. That's why, no matter who's president, the truth of 9/11 continues to get covered up, the wars in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Africa continue, and the economic war on the American people continues while the defense budget grows to obscene levels. But back to the focus of today's show, I'm joined today by 9/11 researcher and former radio show host Frank Tolupko, who's going to share with us a little geopolitical history of Russia and the U.S. that hopefully will put Russiagate into some historical context. And then next week's show, we'll address the current frenzy over the alleged Russian hacking of our elections and the lack of evidence for it. So let's begin with the geopolitical history. Frank, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here again.
So, Frank, tell us if there's any historical precedence for our involvement with Russia. Who's after who?
That's a good question, but it goes back many centuries, but I think most of the action is within the last 100 years or plus or so in terms of our involvement with that area of the world. And I have some documents and interesting commentary by people highlighting that.
What happened in 1902?
It was interesting. In 1902, we're talking about England probably already past the peak of their imperial power in the world. Things were starting to get a little dicey because other countries were industrializing, such as Japan, Eastern Europe, certainly the Americas. One called Halford John Mackinder in England proposed a geographical pivot of history, also known as the Heartland Theory, or simply the pivot of history. And it's a geostrategic theory that was first proposed by him in 1904. It was an article submitted by Mackinder in 1904 to the Royal Geographical Society that advanced his Heartland Theory. Now, what is the Heartland Theory? His personal objective in presenting this Heartland Theory was to warn Britain that its traditional reliance on sea power, which made it an imperial power around the world, would become a weakness as improved land transport opened up the heartland for invasion and or industrialization. Now, what's the heartland?
What is the heartland?
The heartland lay at the center of the world island. I'll explain these terms as we go along. Stretching, the heartland was stretching from the Volga to the Yangtze, essentially from Russia all the way through to China, and from north to south from the Himalayas to the Arctic. Mackinder's heartland was the area that was then ruled by the Russian Empire, and after that by the Soviet Union. So why are they talking about that particular area? Well, as I mentioned, the British imperial power was then waning at that point, and America still wasn't on the world stage. And his famous dictum was, who rules East Europe commands the heartland. The heartland is what I just defined. And who rules the heartland commands the world island. Well, the world island is the rest of the territory surrounding what I described as the heartland. And who rules the world island commands the world. So he was saying that to maintain hegemony over the world, they, whoever was in power, had to rule those particular areas. One for markets, raw materials, and energy resources. Jumping ahead approximately about 100 years, that same theory still held. One Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, many people will know about Brzezinski's national security advisor to many presidents, Carter, Reagan, the Clintons, etc., and wrote extensively and proposed many activities to support American hegemony around the world, including hiring what became Al-Qaeda to sucker the Russians into Afghanistan. He wrote in 1998, and this is before 9/11, which he stated, Eurasia, and that's that same area that we were discussing, the heartland, Eurasia, however, retains its geopolitical importance. Not only is its western periphery, Europe, still the location of much of the world's political and economic power, but its eastern region, Asia, has lately become a vital center of economic growth and rising political influence. Hence, the issue of how a globally engaged America, now we're not talking about England anymore, a globally engaged America copes with the complex Eurasian power relationships, and particularly whether it prevents the emergence of a dominant and antagonistic Eurasian power. In other words, we're talking about going up and maybe up against the Russians, maybe against the Chinese, or maybe some aspect of Western Europe. Anyway, whether it prevents the emergence of a dominant and antagonistic Eurasian power remains central to America's capacity to exercise global primacy. It follows that in addition to cultivating the various novel dimensions of power, technology, that's the internet, communications, that's also the internet, information, as well as trade and finance, American foreign policy must remain concerned with the geopolitical dimensions and must employ its influence in Eurasia in a manner that creates a stable continental equilibrium with the United States as the political arbiter. In other words, we're going to be the sheriff. Eurasia is thus the chessboard on which the struggle for global primacy continues to be played. That's 100 years later. He actually, in the book, quotes Mr. Mackinder and says that that was the genesis of this whole theory. And just jumping quickly, because we'll come back to this later, in the same book, wrote this book in 1998, is talking about the various contenders for power and the various contenders and pretenders for power. He states, Ukraine, a new and important space on the Eurasian chessboard, is a geopolitical pivot because its very existence as an independent country helps to transform Russia. Without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a Eurasian empire. Therefore, what he's saying is it's a contest between us, perhaps, and the Russians, as he viewed it, for the control of this whole heartland and the world empire. And the Ukraine would strip Russia of any control or the ability to exercise that hegemony. Now, going back, of course, we just spanned approximately 100 years, but you could see that this policy was in effect after the Soviet Revolution in 1917. For instance, the Soviets were calling for a united front against the rise of Nazi power in Germany because they felt threatened, as well as they thought that England would be threatened, France and the United States and all you know, the large industrial powers. But their efforts at forming a united front against the rise of Nazism were rebuffed. So in September 30th, 1938, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and French Premier Edouard Daladier and French Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain signed the Munich Pact, which sealed the fate of Czechoslovakia and perhaps the Soviet Union as well, virtually handing it over to Germany in the name of peace. Although the agreement was to give into Hitler's hands only the Sudetenland, that part of Czechoslovakia where 3 million ethnic Germans lived, it also handed over, and a lot of people don't talk about this, it also handed over to the Nazi war machine 66% of Czechoslovakia's coal, 70% of its iron and steel, and 70% of its electrical power. Without these resources, the Czech nation was left vulnerable to complete German domination. In fact, they were arming the Germans to go further east. They were encouraging them to go further east in an attempt to destroy the Soviet Union to gain hegemony over this heartland that we were talking about earlier. That's only one example of that. Again, I'm not necessarily defending the Soviet Union or Stalin's rule, etc., but this is the geopolitical game that was being played. In fact, Harry Truman at one point got up in Congress. There was a debate about forming an alliance with the Soviet Union, and he directly put it out. He said, why should we form an alliance with the Soviet Union against the Germans? We want the Soviet Union to be defeated, and Germany was the nominated power to do that.
And I want to reiterate what Frank is saying. We're not here defending anyone country or over another. We're just putting out what we believe to be the facts.
We're talking about the grand chessboard, the games that are being played for world control of resources, economies, people, labor, etc. I mean, that's what's going on. It's a game being played by all sides, either in defense or offense. In some cases, some countries are offensive. For instance, after the Second World War, the Soviets bargaining for and getting control of a lot of Eastern Europe was not so much the control, I think, but it was to prevent further German invasions where they needed a buffer. Now, what they did there can be defended or criticized, but it was, again, another game, a geopolitical game that was being played to protect their sovereignty, as we would.
Right, and it's important to understand this history because it leads us up to the geopolitical games that are going on today, and that's why we're doing this, so that people will understand where we're at today and how we got there.
Okay, so World War II is over. The Soviets are victorious, at least in Eastern Europe. A deadly amount of losses, 30 to 40 million people killed, etc. And they're picking themselves up by the bootstraps, obviously without any foreign aid, as Western Europe got. And they again became a threat to the United States hegemony over this particular Eurasian area. And that began to bother the people in power here in the United States because they wanted to be able to control what was going on for their own interests. So with the advent of Reagan in 1980, a plan was put together to try to destabilize the Soviet Union. And we have here a clip from Sean Gervais. Actually, it was a talk that was given in Westchester in 1992. In that particular speech is given after the fall of the Soviet Union, as we knew it then, but it refers back to what went on in 1980 after the advent of the Reagan administration. Let me just give a little background on who Mr. Gervais is. Sean Gervais was born in 1933 and died in 1996, spent the latter part of his career exposing the role of the United States and Western powers in the breakup of the USSR and Yugoslavia. He was then working on a book, Balkan Roulette, at the time of his death. Gervais was an economist trained at the University of Geneva, Oxford, and Cornell. His political career began when he took a post as an economic advisor in the Kennedy administration. He then resigned in protest after the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. So this guy is well-versed, well-educated, and I guess respected in the academic community.
Had the inside scoop.
And he gave the speech in 92 and describing about the preparation for what happened in the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right, so, and we're only going to play about 8 minutes of this speech.
Right.
And my apologies in advance for some of the flaws in the sound quality. It's an older recording from 1992. So here he is, Sean Gervais.
Reagan launched, as you know, a massive, a serious, intense, ugly confrontation with the Soviet Union, ideologically, right? At the same time, we became aware that there was a significant drive on to rearm the United States, to throw enormous resources. Ultimately, it was in excess of $1.7 trillion during the 1980s. To throw enormous resources into the military sector, to throw enormous resources into shifting the technology of the military sector, war in space, SDI, etc. All of those things were on the agenda. But many of us at the time puzzled about this. I remember asking myself, what is it these fellows are up to? These fellows, they really want a world war? Can they not see that this can be the outcome? And I remember those discussions, and I remember when many of you and I, on June 12, 1982, were at the demonstration of 750,000 to 1 million people in the center of New York City, which was an expression of the alarm that people felt at this enormous aggressive policy which was coming out of the Reagan administration, which threatened to shred U.S.-Soviet relations. But in fact, retrospectively, we can see that there was something else behind it, that it was not just irrational madness. There was a bit of that, but there was a rationality to what was being done. And in fact, to understand that, it's important to see that it is connected to every single major line of innovative policy that the Reagan administration developed. It was extremely well thought out, extremely shrewd. And the military buildup and the aggressive rhetoric towards the Soviet Union, the deliberate effort to create difficulties in the relationships between the Soviet Union and the European powers. You remember that in 1982, the United States tried to force the European powers not to accept natural gas from the Soviet Union, to deny shipments of technology to the Soviet Union, which would make it possible for the Soviet Union to exploit that national gas, to earn foreign exchange, etc. It was all part of a very complex strategy, but it was a very clear strategy. Let me say that although many of us, at least I did at the time, missed that, while we didn't quite comprehend what was going on, but had in the back of our mind flickers that something was wrong, there were people who were saying or hinting clearly at what was happening, and shrewd people, intelligent people, who did begin to grasp what was happening. Let me quote from one or two. Writing in 1982, Joe Fromm, who was then the editor of the United States U.S. News and World Report, said, there was something behind, I'm quoting him, the shift to a harder line in foreign policy. The U.S., in fact, seemed to be, quote, waging limited economic warfare against Russia to to force the Soviets to reform their political system. You know, that's a nice journalist, a reasonably liberal journalist at U.S. News and World Report. But Joe then quoted a State Department official saying, actually, National Security Council, quote, "The Soviet Union is in deep, deep economic and financial trouble. By squeezing wherever we can, our purpose is to induce the Soviets to reform their system. I think we will see results over the next several years." That's in 1982. Robert Scheer wrote a book in 1982 called With Enough Shovels, Reagan and Bush in the Age of Nuclear War. I think I've got the title almost right. Very interesting book, in which Scheer saw that there was something behind this enormously aggressive foreign policy, foreign and military policy, that the Reagan administration was deploying. And he saw that the United States was not simply playing nuclear chicken with the Soviet Union, as he put it, but that it was embarked on a policy designed to create such pressure for the Soviet Union as to force changes within the Soviet Union. Now, of course, it had always been the case that the Cold War consisted of moves designed to affect the behavior of others, okay? The Cold War, from the point of view of the West, had always aimed at modifying, as the State Department cookie pushers like to put it in their delicate prose, the behavior of our antagonist. But this, I think you will see, went beyond that. Because, in fact, the Reagan administration embarked on a policy of many dimensions, which included pressure around the world on countries with close ties to the Soviet Union. Insurgencies were initiated in Mozambique, Angola, Cambodia against Vietnam, Nicaragua, and Afghanistan. I mean, I don't want to get into too many complicated discussions of Afghanistan, but I think anybody who reflects upon the United States' response to the Soviet entry into Afghanistan in 1979 must realize that the United States did not want the Soviet Union to leave Afghanistan. And in fact, the purpose of these pro-insurgencies around the world, which, as you know, have expended billions of dollars, was to pin the Soviet Union down and to inflict economic costs upon the Soviet Union. The purpose of the remilitarization in the West was to force the Soviet Union, at the risk of exposing itself to the pressure of escalation, to meet our resource commitments to defend itself or to place itself in a position to resist our pressure. The purpose of escalating the technology of nuclear warfare again was to impose costs upon the Soviet Union. The purpose of every principal measure, such as withholding advanced technology from the Soviet Union, foreign assistance programs aimed not at assisting countries on the basis of their needs, but at assisting countries on the basis of the contribution they would make to putting pressure on the Soviet Union, all of these things were part of a systematic strategy designed to create havoc on the Soviet Union.
And again, that was Sean Gervasi speaking in 1992. And you can find that full video on YouTube by just searching for Sean, S-E-A-N, and Gervasi, G-E-R-V-A-S-I. So the Reagan administration has been successful in disarming and destabilizing the Soviet Union, bringing it to economic collapse. And Frank, tell us what happens next.
Okay, so the Soviet Union has been economically destroyed because of armament expenditures, the war in Afghanistan, etc. And they're on the brink of dissolution. Gorbachev is in power, and negotiations have been initiated between the U.S. and Gorbachev to decide, and also the NATO powers to decide what's going to happen to the remains of the Soviet Union. So, as we know, they created independent states at some point, and they ceded control of their Eastern European allies, I guess we would call them at that point, because they all had signed the Warsaw Agreements, and the U.S. was then negotiating further terms, economic terms, as well as political terms. Interestingly enough, there is an article by one Eric Zeus, and it's entitled How the U.S. Swindled Russia in the Early 1990s, and it's based on the release from the National Security Archives, the memoranda that came out of those negotiations. And it says here, due to a historic data dump on December 10th, this is in 2017, the biggest swindle that occurred in the 20th century, or perhaps ever, is now proven as a historical fact. And this swindle was done by the U.S. government against the government and people of Russia. And it continues today and keeps getting worse under every U.S. president. But it was secretly started by U.S. President George Herbert Bush. The swindle has been finally displayed beyond question. By this, the first ever complete release of the evidence, it demonstrates beyond any reasonable doubt that U.S. President Bush and his team lied through their teeth to Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and his team to end the Cold War on Russia's side. When the U.S. team were secretly determined never to end it on the U.S. and NATO side until Russia itself is conquered. And this swindle continues today and keeps getting worse and worse for Russians. So what was the swindle? Well, they had promised, and they said that if the Soviet Union dissolved and released from control of their Eastern European states, such as Hungary, Poland, etc., that NATO would not march one step forward towards the East. But that was all a lie. They had been secretly planning, and that's what these documents indicate, that they were crossing their fingers behind their back. And Gorbachev bought into that. And as we all know now, all these countries are now within the NATO fold and armed to the teeth surrounding Russia. So that further put Russia at odds with competing American power. I guess as a result of this, some people found out, saw what was going on because their economy was totally being destroyed at that point. So with the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, its allies, its socialist republics, all then being on their own supposedly, and all clamoring for NATO membership, things began to become increasingly economically worse in the Soviet Union. This is under Yeltsin's rule, this starting in the early 90s. Let us consider some of the consequences of Yeltsin's regime. In the first years of the Yeltsin privatization scheme, that's where they made deals with foreign powers to get hold of the natural resources and markets in Russia. The life expectancy of a Russian male fell from 65 years to 57.5 years. Female life expectancy in Russia dropped from 75 years in 1989 to 72.8 years in 1999. Throughout the Yeltsin's terms as president, flight of capital away from Russia totaled between $1 and $2 billion every month. Each year from 89 to 2001, there was a fall of approximately 8% in Russia's productive assets. From 1990 to 1999, the percentage increase of people living on less than a dollar a day was greater in Russia and other former socialist countries than anywhere else in the world. The number of people living in poverty in the former Soviet republics rose from 14 million in 89 to 147 million in 1998. As a result of the 1998 financial collapse and the devaluation of the ruble, the life savings of tens of millions of Russian families disappeared overnight. Since then, the Great Recession and low oil prices have only made matters worse. In the period from 92 to 98, Russia's GDP fell by half, something that did not happen even during the German invasion in the Second World War. Okay, so we have Yeltsin in power, the country is being economically decimated, etc., but he's up for election in 1996. So, according to a Marco Melkonian writing in 2017, he discusses how that election was run in 96. In the run-up to the 96 presidential election in Russia, opinion polls put the pro-Western incumbent Boris Yeltsin in fifth place among the presidential candidates with only 8% support. The same polls show that the most popular candidate in Russia by a wide margin was the Communist Party's Gennady Zhuganov. Moved to desperation by the numbers, well-connected Russian oligarchs suggested that just canceling the election and supporting a military takeover rather than facing a defeat at the polls. Neocons in the West embraced the idea, all in the name of democracy, with a capital D, of course. In the end, though, Yeltsin and the oligarchs decided to retain power by staging the election. In keeping with Russian laws by the time, Zhuganov spent less than $3 million on his campaign. Estimates of Yeltsin's spending, by contrast, range from $700 million to $2.5 billion. This is documented by David Kotz in Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin in 2007 book. In February 96, at the urging of the United States, the International Monetary Fund, which described itself as an organization of 188 countries, supplied a $10.2 billion emergency infusion to Russia. The money disappeared as Yeltsin used it to shore up his reputation and buy votes. He forced the Central Bank of Russia to provide an additional $1 billion for his campaign, too. Meanwhile, a handful of Russian oligarchs, notably several big contributors residing in Israel, provided more billions for the Yeltsin campaign. Campaign strategists from the former Republican governor of California, Pete Wilson, covertly made their way to the President Hotel in Moscow, where behind a guard and locked doors, they served as Yeltsin's secret campaign weapon to save Russia for democracy. Yeltsin and his cohorts monopolized all major media outlets, print and electronic, public and private. They bombarded Russians with an incessant and uncontested barrage of political advertising masquerading as news, phony documentaries, rumors, innuendos, and bad faith campaign promises, including disbursement of back pay to workers and pensioners, stopping further NATO expansion and peaceful settlement of Yeltsin's brutal war against Chechnya. Yeltsin campaigners even floated the threat that he would stage a coup and the country would descend into civil war if Zhuganov were to win the vote. So we're talking about involvement in foreign elections is exactly what the United States did through the IMF and through a Republican strategist. We did that in 96.
Yeah, so we can see by this that meddling in elections is something we're quite familiar with. So Gorbachev and Yeltsin were kind of under the power of the West. They were doing the bidding of the U.S. government, essentially.
Well, I think Gorbachev was snookered, but Yeltsin was totally, I mean, he was totally inoperative. He was an alcoholic, and he was totally under their control. He would disappear for weeks at a time. The oligarchs were in charge, many of them living outside of Russia. It was no longer the Soviet Union, making bucks, etc. So Putin ascends the power, which is a story in and of itself. But anyway, he's in power now at the turn of the century. So, according to Mark Harkett in an article entitled Springtime for Russophobia, Putin, the New Hitler, and Anti-Russian Propaganda. No longer yielding to leadership from the wolves of Wall Street, independent powers, and this was written in 2014 now, have begun to challenge the foundations of the Washington Consensus. At the forefront of this movement has been a revived Russia, which in the face of NATO encirclement and with survival on the line has shown itself willing and able to confront the Pax Americana. But the show must go on, as the United States positions forces ever closer toward Moscow's frontiers, with furrowed brows and feigned concern. The talking heads on our telescreens mechanically inform us of Russian aggression. It's springtime again for Russophobia in the West. With its roots in the great game of espionage and intrigue between Victorian subalterns and the Tsar's Cossacks in Central Asia, a systemic antipathy to Russia as such only took root in America from the time it assumed Britain's imperial mantle at the dawn of the Cold War. The hostility, of course, has been mutual. The Russians have not forgotten how their land suffered through the peace dividend of U.S. unipolarity in the 1990s. Promised that the North Atlantic Alliance would never contemplate expanding eastward, Mikhail Gorbachev starred in pizza commercials and Boris Yeltsin headlined summits with his trademark vodka-soaked buffoonery. It was then that a weak and bankrupt Russia could be looted by multinationals, its people impoverished and demoralized, and the state further subverted by forces from civil society, NGOs, to cutthroat jihadist mercenaries waging holy war in the North Caucasus. But those days of humiliation are over, according to the Russians, and that's what has Washington worried. During his 15 years of authoritarian rule, Russia's President Putin set his country on a new path after a disastrous post-Soviet decline. Early on, he thwarted the ambitions of oligarchs and regional separatists. Since then, he has moved to counter U.S.-NATO plans for controlling Eurasia and its energy transit networks. The struggle has played out through espionage, color-coded revolutions, pipeline double-crosses, and proxy wars. After a naval task force dispatched by Moscow effectively deterred the West from bombing Syria in 2013, U.S. foreign policy planners decided to upend Russian resurgence through a quick and dirty destabilization of the Ukraine.
So as you can see, there's a long history of the U.S. trying to destabilize Russia. If you'd like more information on the recent upheaval in the Ukraine, I can recommend two sources. One is a video called Ukraine on Fire by Oliver Stone, and even Oliver Stone can't get the theaters to show this film. And then there's a book called Flashpoint Ukraine by Stephen Lendman. And again, that's Flashpoint Ukraine by Stephen Lendman. And Frank, I really want to thank you for providing us with that informative background on U.S., Soviet, and now Russian history together. And thanks for being on the show today.
Great. It was a pleasure.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.